The news from Washington, D.C. and Trump Tower kept journalists pretty busy over the weekend. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us to talk about the Trump cabinet and whether the Secretary of State position is a done deal. Mary Nichols is the head of the California Air Resources Board. She spoke with Capital Public Radio's Ben Bradford about the new Trump administration and their strategy moving forward. A Sacramento State English professor has released her first novel, Sometimes We Tell the Truth. It's a modern retelling of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. And there's a new organization in town designed to keep jazz alive. We'll talk with founder Carolyn Swayze about the Sacramento Jazz Cooperative and her vision for a permanent performance space that embraces the many styles of jazz. I'm Beth Duncan, in for Beth Ruyak. That's today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Duncan, in for Beth Ruyak. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us this morning for a look at the latest news about the Trump cabinet and a lot more. Too bad there's nothing happening on Capitol Hill, Ken.
I know. I figured that's why Beth Ruyak took the day off. I mean, there's nothing going on.
Absolutely not. So do we have a Secretary of State, do you think, that is going to is his, you know, the cabinet member that he wants going to go through?
Well, those are two different questions. One, we don't know if he's going to even be nominated. We're talking about Rex Tillerson, who's a nominee for Secretary of State. He is the CEO of ExxonMobil, which is kind of interesting. But what's interesting about Tillerson is that, one, he is very strong a supporter of Vladimir Putin. He has very strong relations with Putin. And he's also pushed for oil exploration in Russia, where he's always been a foe of sanctions against Russia. And so this fits in with Donald Trump's philosophy about Russia. But of course, it comes at a time when Russia is under further scrutiny about what involvement it may or may not have had regarding the election. Now, also, whether he can be confirmed or not is another question as well.
What do we really know about Tillerson's relationship with Russia? Obviously, the business dealings, but is there a closer relationship that we're being made aware of as we go along with this situation?
Well, I mean, all we know, I mean, he was decorated by Russia. He won the Order of Friendship decoration in 2012, which is just an indication that he supports strong relationships with Russia. And it was interesting when Mitt Romney in 2012 said Russia was our biggest enemy. Everybody said, "Oh no, you don't know what you're talking about." Then suddenly it now seems like it's Russia who is the biggest enemy, and everybody agrees with it except Donald Trump, who yesterday on Fox News basically said that there's no evidence that Russia may have tried to influence the election and things like that, and he's on the other side, the opposite side of the intelligence agencies. But having said that, back to Rex Tillerson, I mean, he is somebody who is a business guy first, doesn't have really many foreign relation credentials, which is interesting because he's going to be perhaps nominated for Secretary of State. And we heard good things about him from Kellyanne Conway, who was Trump's campaign manager. But again, if there is strong opposition, if there's any indication that he might not get the nomination, maybe the nomination won't even happen at all.
And we are aware now of bipartisan concerns about the Russian influence on the election. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell spoke at a news conference this morning. We have a soundbite.
Obviously, any foreign breach of our cybersecurity measures is disturbing, and I strongly condemn any such efforts. Prior to the election, the Director of National Intelligence released a statement saying that the Russian government directed the recent compromises of emails from U.S. persons and institutions, including from U.S. political organizations.
So, Ken, how soon do you think we could actually see an investigation into Russia's potential tampering?
Well, John McCain, who's the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, says that even without even waiting for the other intelligence agencies to work on this, McCain says he's ready to start an investigation right now, and it should be bipartisan. Other Republicans like Rand Paul, Lindsey Graham, Jim Lankford of Oklahoma, they've all suggested that there should be an investigation. And it's interesting because, as Trump said yesterday, that it's ridiculous, that I don't believe it. These guys, meaning the intelligence agencies, are the same guys who came up with the weapons of mass destruction for Saddam Hussein in 2002. So Trump is dismissing it completely. Congress seems to be on another page.
What are the obviously there's a huge amount of talk right now about Rex Tillerson, but what other key cabinet positions are we looking at that are unannounced and undecided?
Well, let's see. There are a few that we don't know. I mean, basically, most of them have been named, you know, Attorney General, HHS, HUD, Education. There are a few that have not been named yet. I don't think there's any as much as controversy as the president-elect hasn't gotten around to that yet. Of course, there's a lot of controversies about some of the ones he has named. For example, Tom Price, the congressman from Georgia, is nominated for Secretary of Health and Human Services, and Tom Price is a big foe of Obamacare. But I don't know why people should be so shocked at that, because Donald Trump campaigned on repealing and getting rid of Obamacare, so that seems to make sense. There's some question about whether Ben Carson, who's a doctor, should be head of housing and urban development. There's some questions about that. But most of the controversial ones have been named, except, as we said, for Secretary of State.
So last week, Ken, Donald Trump was selected as Time Magazine's Person of the Year. And then on Friday, the president-elect took a poll on what people thought of that naming convention.
You know, Time Magazine, they were both nice and a little bit wise guy yesterday. They gave me the Person of the Year. It used to be called the Man of the Year. Now it's called the Person of the Year. That's good. They're politically correct. They were very politically correct. Who'd rather have it the Man of the Year? Look, the women are all... Okay, seriously, because I want it's Person of the Year.
So, do you believe Trump's attacks on the so-called PC culture are going to continue into office?
Did I ever believe it would stop? Of course not. Once he was elected, people say, well, maybe he won't be doing everything by Twitter, but he's still attacking his perceived enemies. He's still tweeting at 2 o'clock in the morning. He still thinks that the greatest enemy in the world besides China is probably Saturday Night Live. So he's out. He still has his enemies list. He's still out there, and I don't see him changing at all. Look, it worked for him so far. We never thought he should be Person of the Year. We never thought he would get to be the nominee, let alone survive Iowa and New Hampshire. He survived Iowa and New Hampshire, won the nomination, and won the election. Whether it's Russian interference or whatever, there are a lot of reasons why Hillary Clinton lost the election that can't be blamed on Russia, can't be blamed on Donald Trump. And he's the guy, barring some shocking thing that's going to happen in the Electoral College on December 19th, and that won't happen. There won't be a shocking result there. Donald Trump takes over January 20th.
I'm talking with political junkie Ken Rudin. Mitch McConnell's wife being nominated to the cabinet. Any ripples from that appointment, so to speak, or appointment to be?
Well, actually, she's more than Mitch McConnell's wife. Elaine Chao is very accomplished in her own right. She served in the Bush cabinet. It's interesting. She, like Elizabeth Dole, both served as transportation secretary and labor secretary, and were both married to Senate majority leaders. That was interesting. But, you know, talk about draining the swamp. This is not a criticism of Elaine Chao at all, but she has the kind of credentials that the Republican establishment really, really likes. It's the other people, the outsiders, the Michael Flynn's of the world, the people who shock people and surprise people. Elaine Chao is not one of them.
All right, let's switch gears just a little bit. I mean, not really, but just a little bit. Anyway, the official Electoral College vote is next week. Is there still a group or a movement that's actually expecting the EC to, dump Trump?
Well, the movement is there. That hasn't gone away. I mean, there are a bunch of groups, a bunch of people who somehow think they're going to convince. I think Donald Trump right now has 306 electoral votes. You need 270 to be elected. So basically, they're talking about changing the minds of 30 electors before the Electoral College meets on December 19th, change their mind to pull away, either to vote for Hillary Clinton, which is not likely to happen, or pick a different Republican, which is also not likely to happen. In the history of these so-called faithless electors, maybe one, maybe even two will switch over the course of a presidential election, but 30, not likely to happen. There is one Republican elector in Texas who said he won't vote for Trump, but I think there are two Democratic electors in Washington State who are not fans of Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton won the state of Washington, so there are dreams out there that somehow the recount in Michigan, the Jill Stein paid for a recount, would change people's minds. That's not going to happen, and there's also a dream about December 19th. 14th that the electors will come to their senses and not pick Donald Trump. That's not going to happen either.
And how are those Stein recounts actually going? And also, what's the real purpose, do you think, in demanding the recounts?
Well, you know something, it's interesting. Donald Trump, when he was boasting about how well he did in the election, and he did well certainly in the Electoral College. Of course, right now he's 2.8 million votes behind Hillary Clinton. But let's remind everybody, that's not how you elect a president, not by popular vote, by Electoral College. But Donald Trump talked about how there were so many millions of illegal votes taken. It was going to be a rigged election. So when Jill Stein and some Democratic groups attempted to pay for recounts in Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, the Republicans said, wait a second, we can't have this. But as it turns out, I think they counted over 75% of the vote in the Wisconsin recount, and Hillary Clinton picked up a net total of 82 votes. They got rid of the recount in Michigan because, according to state law there, you have to be an aggrieved person to bring forth a recount, and Jill Stein, who finished fourth as the Green Party nominee, was hardly an aggrieved person. And it looks like the recount is not happening in Pennsylvania either. So whatever dreams Democrats may have had of reversing the election, it's not going to happen in those recounts.
And talking about the Democrats, what is happening now, Ken, with the election of the new DNC chairman?
Well, that's also a little bit contentious. I mean, Howard Dean, the former chair, dropped out of the race last week. Most attention seems to be on Keith Ellison, the congressman from Minnesota. He is one of two Muslim Americans in Congress, and he seems to be the front runner. He's gotten the endorsement of a lot of groups, including the AFL-CIO, Chuck Schumer, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren. He seems to be the front runner, but there are a bunch of Jewish groups led by the ADL who are accusing Ellison of saying things about Israel in the past, things about Louis Farrakhan in the past, and they're accusing him of saying in the past anti-Semitic stuff. Keith Ellison and his allies saying this is hogwash, it's a smear campaign. Ellison has to be the front runner, and he says that if he is elected, the election won't be until February, he says if he is elected, he will resign his seat from Congress and be a full-time chairman.
Finally, Ken, I wanted to give you an opportunity to give us your thoughts on the passing of John Glenn.
You know something? I didn't expect this question, but I'm glad you asked it, Beth, because whenever you think of the word hero, you have to think of John Glenn. This guy was, you know, I mean, he was the first person to orbit the Earth. He was a quiet, unassuming guy. He was elected to the Senate on his almost third try. He tried in 64, then dropped out, tried in 70, lost the Democratic primary, but came back in 74 and served, three terms. He was extremely popular in Ohio. He didn't make it to the presidency, but there was always a decency about him, a calmness, and it, you know, whether he was circling the Earth in 1962 or going up in space again in the 1990s, he was the right stuff, a real thing, and, you know, I guess the word hero certainly applies to John Glenn.
We have more information on our website, capradio.org. Ken Rudin, always great to chat with you. Thanks for joining us on Insight.
Thank you so much, Beth.
And coming up, we're going to be talking about the California Air Resources Board and their plans under a Trump administration. I'm Beth Duncan. You're listening to Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Duncan in for Beth Riak. As we head into the new year, what plans are being made for California's Air Resources Board? Capital Public Radio's Ben Bradford recently spoke with Mary Nichols, chair of the board, about its goals for 2017, including the future of cap and trade, which is set to expire in 2020. They also discussed the potential impact of a Trump administration on fighting catastrophic climate change and the appointment of Scott Pruitt as head of the Environmental Protection Agency. Ben began the conversation by asking Mary Nichols about their outlook for next year.
We have a very big year ahead of us. We're going to be putting out a plan for how California is going to reach the goal of bringing our emissions of greenhouse gases down to 40% below 1990 levels by 2030. We also have ahead of us the obligation to do a new state implementation plan for ozone and for fine particles. And for California, that means, and actually it all sort of ties together in the sense that both of them focus back on motor vehicles and our transportation system. So what we're talking about really is what the future of cars and trucks and buses and ships and planes and how they move around is going to be for California.
And there are pretty ambitious goals in terms of what the state has to do that. Is that something that, like, with current technology we can hit those goals, or do things need to be developed that we don't currently have?
We can show how you can meet those targets with technologies that we know about today. There's nothing that's so far out there that it hasn't been thought of yet. But you really have to search and study and think about how you can adapt technologies and expand them and make them more affordable. For example, zero-emission vehicles. We have the largest fleet of electric vehicles anywhere in the world in California, but we're still only at 250,000 vehicles, and we're going to have to go way beyond that. So it isn't so much a matter of inventing a new technology, but of refining the technology that exists, making it more affordable for ordinary buyers, and making it more usable by having the kind of network of fueling stations, charging stations out there that will make it really work.
And then one of the key sort of levers the state has had over the last few years in terms of reducing emissions has been the cap and trade program that's set to expire in 2020. And this is a market-based approach where companies can buy allowances for their emissions. What would you like to see happen with that program?
Well, first of all, the program doesn't technically expire. It's true that we would not be wanting to extend it and make it more stringent without legislative support and approval, but the program wouldn't just come to a screeching halt in 2020. It's pretty clear from the language of the law itself that wouldn't make sense. You'd at least maintain it even if you didn't get a reauthorization. But of course, the governor and we both feel strongly that the program deserves to be continued. We think cap and trade is a workable tool. It's operated with no scandals, no disruptions, and with great compliance. Industry actually prefers cap and trade to our other more specific regulatory programs like the Renewable Electricity Standard or the Low Carbon Fuel Standard.
Obviously, there's a bit of a dispute between the executive branch versus the legislature and legislative council about whether there's the authority there or whether it needs to be extended by statute. And then just a couple other brief things I wanted to ask you about cap and trade. This year, two of the four auctions came in well under what the projections were. Do you think that suggest anything about the program's viability?
One of the things about a cap-and-trade program is that it's not operated for the purpose of raising revenue. It's operated for the purpose of giving you emissions reductions at a known price. And so we didn't design the program in order to assure a steady flow of income to the state. The point of the program is that sources that are covered by cap and trade should be able to get the allowances that they need to be in compliance with our regulations and to do it at an affordable price. If sources have been able to clean up enough so that they don't need to buy the allowances, we're just as happy. If you wanted to run a pricing program, a carbon pricing program, just for the purpose of getting revenue, you would do a tax.
And ARB just released kind of a three different options with cap and trade continuing, with regulations, and then with a carbon tax. What would the regulations consist of generally if in lieu of cap and trade? And do you think that's something that would encourage businesses to kind of clamor for the market-based program to continue?
We are trying to put together some scenarios so that the public and the legislature can look at what's available as a way to reach the carbon targets. If you were looking at more regulation than we already have, what you would do first is basically tighten down on all the existing regulations. You have more stringent requirements for the low carbon fuel standard. Instead of a 10%, you'd go to 25% reduction in carbon, or you'd increase the requirements for renewable electricity. And all of those things will probably happen to some extent anyway. If you look at new things that you could regulate in California, it tends to focus you more on areas that up until now really haven't been regulated, which would include agriculture, forestry, other kinds of land use activities. It probably would involve more action on the part of local governments, cities, especially in terms of trying to find ways to reduce the amount of driving that people do and to change land use patterns. But we didn't create this set of scenarios in order to make the alternative to cap and trade look ugly. It might be politically smart to do that, but unfortunately, we're kind of straight arrows around here. We look at the facts, we look at the data, we try to actually develop proposals that will work.
And, you know, of course, all this is to combat climate change, and we're in a critical period, and we now have a Trump administration, and now we know an EPA head who have rejected mainstream climate science, and the EPA head, Scott Pruitt, actually sued the Obama administration over the Clean Power Plan, which is federal regulation that would have required states to cut back on carbon emissions. Have we lost the ability to prevent catastrophic climate change?
Well, in answer to your question, have we lost the ability to prevent catastrophic climate change? No, mainly because preventing catastrophic climate change isn't something that's on the U.S. alone. It's a global problem. It requires global action. And what we've seen, at least in the most recent meeting of the parties to the Paris Agreement, every country that signed on to the Paris Agreement is taking action. You know, they're coming up with their plans, they're making their national commitments, and they're taking action. And the business community, the global businesses that are the ones that really have to be at the forefront of financing the activities that are going to have to take place in Africa, in Latin America, as well as Asia and Europe, these places are all staying the course. They haven't suddenly woken up and said, oh, well, I guess if Mr. Trump is elected, we must have to just quit doing anything about climate. Now, what will happen as a result of the perturbations that are going on, you know, in Washington right now, it's really a little too early. The nominee for EPA, Mr. Pruitt, certainly has a long and well-documented history of climate opposition. He also has a record as a lawyer of losing most of his cases against EPA. I mean, he sued EPA a lot, and he very seldom wins. So the irony of this, in a way, is that now maybe he'll be at EPA so he can perhaps undo what was done, and the whole litigation will just go away. But that doesn't mean that climate action is going to stop, either officially or unofficially. You know, unofficially, companies that are investing in cleaner fuels, that are working in the alternative energy space, are going to continue doing it. So I think that there's going to be some confusion for a while, for sure. And those states and those people in the private sector who were looking for an excuse to drag their heels may get to drag their heels a little bit longer, but I don't think it's going to be enough to turn around the direction that the world is going in.
And you've worked at the EPA before.
I have.
ARB has a lot of kind of independence from the EPA in terms of the regulations that we have in California, but how much control can the EPA take over our state regulations?
The Federal Clean Air Act, which is the basic law that climate action has been based on, is going to stay intact unless and until Congress repeals it. The Supreme Court has already ruled that greenhouse gas emissions are a danger to health and to the environment, and so EPA is under a mandate from the highest court in the land to develop plans and take action to reduce greenhouse gases. So this isn't something that a new EPA administrator can come in and just reverse. Now, you know, a determined band of marauders who were willing to continue, you know, efforts to withdraw, repeal, overturn every single regulation that was ever developed under the Clean Air Act could probably do a fair amount of damage. But even then, many states, using their own legal authority, would continue with these measures. And, you know, in a sense, this isn't that different from what was going on under the last Bush administration, where you had an administration that was opposed to taking action on climate, Congress that wasn't willing to act. But you had a group of states, and they weren't all Democrat, that for whatever reasons decided they wanted to move forward anyhow. So I just think it's, you know, you can come up with hypotheses or scenarios under which the federal government could really work to try to undermine any kind of state action on climate. You know, hypothetically, they could try to withhold federal funding from states that had a climate program. And you can imagine a parade of evil, horrible things that could happen. But I don't think it does much good to start preparing for that.
Have there been changes at ARB in terms of what you're working on, in terms of strategy, in terms of work on the Clean Power Plan since the election?
Actually, we haven't changed anything we've been doing since the election.
That was Capital Public Radio's Ben Bradford speaking with Mary Nichols from the California Air Resources Board. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a Sac State professor releases a debut novel, Sometimes We Tell the Truth. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Duncan, in for Beth Ruyak. It's time to check the news with Morning Edition Steve Milne. Good morning, Steve.
Hi, Beth. Funeral services have been held for two victims of the warehouse fire in Oakland early this month that killed 36 people. The separate funerals were held yesterday in the Bay Area for video artist Jonathan Birnbaum and the youngest victim, 17-year-old Dravon McGill. Relatives and loved ones described Birnbaum, a 34-year-old Berkeley native and Oakland resident, a smart man who loved all things media. Reward money is being offered for help solving the case of a young man found stabbed to death and buried on the Sonoma State University campus last month. Two rewards totaling more than $7,000 are being offered for help in finding and convicting the killer or killers of 18-year-old Kirk Kimberly of Cotati. 11 bald eagles were spotted during an organized count at sites across Riverside and San Bernardino counties over the weekend. The U.S. Forest Service says bald eagles commonly migrate south to spend their winter vacations around the region's lakes, feasting on fish and ducks. A group of more than 100 eagle-eyed volunteers and agency staff participated in the counts at several lakes on Saturday. Follow us on Twitter at Cap Radio News.
Thanks, Steve.
You're welcome, Beth.
A Sacramento State English professor has released her first novel, Sometimes We Tell the Truth. It's a modern retelling of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. Author Kim Zarens focuses on a group of teens on a bus ride to Washington, D.C. Each student has to tell a story, some fantastical, some realistic, some downright scandalous. And it's all in pursuit of the ultimate prize, a perfect score. So today on Insight, we have Professor Zarens with us, and we're going to hear how and why she came up with the concept for her book. Kim, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Beth.
So tell us right away, why pay homage to Chaucer's Canterbury Tales? It seems like there might be an easier way to do a novel than to have to intersperse a bunch of stories throughout.
Well, I'm a medievalist, as you know, and so I'm really passionate about Chaucer and teaching Chaucer. And so I hope this will be a great story for teenagers that they'll love on its own, but I also hope it can be used to provide an entryway into Chaucer's original text.
So every student essentially gets their own chapter when they're telling their tales. Which character stories would you say came the easiest for you?
Oh, yeah, there was some variation. I think Kai's tale, which I think I'll read a snippet for you today, came pretty easily. Allison's Tale came pretty easily. So, yeah, there were a few that were really on the tip of my tongue.
Who did you relate to the most?
Well, Jeff is the narrator, and so I think being in his head so much made me really relate to him the most.
And maybe the one that was hardest to capture?
I guess that I would say maybe Franklin.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you have an English class like this?
Well, I've been teaching Chaucer for years and medieval literature more broadly. So what's interesting is some of the conversations we had in class were inspiring for me, and I could weave some of the things that we discussed into the actual tales. And so they're not just short stories, but the characters will interrupt each other, and then at the end they'll all debate how the story went. And a lot of that really makes me feel like I'm in the classroom listening to my students.
Is there a portrait of society that you were trying to get to with the writing of this novel?
I think I wanted to convey lots of different lives being lived. So as you saw, some of the stories are scandalous, some are funny, some are serious, and so are the characters. So some of them, they all live very different lives, and I wanted to convey that every single character has a story to tell and has value.
So you write and speak Middle English, but you didn't include that in the book.
No, I thought writing a book in Middle English or even in parts would be a little off-putting for teenagers, but I wanted to use more the stories and the ideas and the concepts.
Yeah, so you have a few lines in your head, you told me. So.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, yeah, you can hear how it sounds very different. My favorite Chaucerian character is the wife of Bath, and she begins the prologue to her tale talking about marriage. So in Middle English, she says, "Experience, though non autorité wherein this world, is right enough for me to speak of woe that is in marriage. For lording us, si the 12 year was of age, thank be God that is eternal leva. Husbands at church door, e have had fever."
Ah.
So she's had 5 husbands.
it sounds so charming.
Yeah, it is charming. It's fun.
I'm talking with Sac State English professor, author Kim Zirins, about her debut book, Sometimes We Tell the Truth. And you have a reading for us from the book.
I do.
We'd love to hear that.
Great. So this is the first tale that's told on the bus, and the character's name is Kai, and he's the quarterback on the bus. He's a wonderful character. And so I'll read a little bit from that.
Great.
So there's this war of the zombies, and they're unstoppable. They can get their hand cut off, stick it back on, and keep on fighting. Total Armageddon. And if humans get in the way, they die. So the humans pray to the gods to stop these monsters, and the gods take that whole battlefield and plunge it down into the underworld. Except the gods miss 2 zombies. One is helping his brother limp off the battlefield, just as the ground under their feet starts to collapse. Ark and Palom are body brothers, zombies who can cut off and share body parts to save each other's lives, as they've done in countless battles. But they are no match for the human army that pours in now that things are safe for humans. The president imprisons the 2 zombies for scientific study in the labs, and the zombies bear it the best they can. Everything changes when they see a gorgeous girl helping out in the lab. She works on the other side of the glass, doing something with test tubes. They don't know it yet, but this is Emily, the president's daughter. She wants a career in science rather than politics, so she works at the lab after school. Ark puts his hands on the glass, and Palom touches his heart. They are totally stunned by the beauty of this warm-blooded young woman. Falling in love is the happiest moment of their unlives. But then, things start to go wrong.
Mm. So definitely talk that would relate to young adults.
Yes. All the stories, zombies, paranormal romance, all these things are readily recognizable genres in YA literature.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about that label of young adult in literature?
I think it's great.
It's great?
Yeah.
Okay. And you did some children's books previously. How did you make that transition?
Well, writers do a lot of writing behind the scenes. So I had two picture books that were published, but I was also working on novels. And like many writers, I had written novels before. So it's not a big surprise to me, but it's something that seems rather different from my previous work.
You mentioned that you're a medievalist at Sacramento State. What does that mean, and how does that play out?
Well, I teach medieval literature in the English department. I teach British literature all the way to Milton or thereabouts, and I mostly just pre-modern literature. Mm-hmm. And so I try to, and I teach it in original Middle English. So that little bit that I said to you from The Wife of Bath, that's what I teach the literature in. So it's an attention to literature and language as well.
Now, on your website, you have a link to a Chaucer playlist with a Nirvana cover, but you don't have the playlist yet. Tell us how that came about. What's that about?
Well, what I have on the website, if you look at the cover of the book, you'll see lots of images. And what that represents is that each character tells a story, and so each character also gets a piece of art. And one character is going to talk about Nirvana. And so that is on the cover. And then I thought it would make a really fun playlist. So I put it on my webpage, but I'm so busy teaching this semester that I didn't actually finish and plug in the playlist itself.
We appreciate you being here today. We are talking with Sac State English professor and author Kim Zarens. Her new book, Sometimes We Tell the Truth. We have links and more information on our website, capradio.org. Kim, we really appreciate you coming in. Thanks for your time.
Oh, thank you so much, Beth.
You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the founder of the new Sacramento Jazz Cooperative. She'll join us in studio. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Duncan. Jazz music has played a critical role in Sacramento's cultural fabric for decades. In an effort to support jazz musicians and educate the public about the genre's rich history, Carolyn Swayze has founded the Sacramento Jazz Cooperative. She joins us in studio to discuss the mission behind the cooperative and the upcoming shows they're hosting and how you can get involved. Carolyn, welcome to Insight.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
First off, let's just know a little bit about your background, and then we'll talk about the cooperative.
Chicago, California, resident by way of Chicago when jazz was front and center. Mm-hmm. And I remember in the 60s, I would go into there was this Rush Street area, and you could start at one end of that strip and you could hear the likes of Miles Davis and Nat Cole and Sarah Vaughan, and the music just continued. And then I left Chicago in the early 70s and relocated to California by way of Fresno. And that is where I actually started my singing career, in the supper clubs of Fresno. I met a piano player there by the name of Dick Scudder, who had been the pianist for Vic Damone when Damone owned a club called The Palms. Hmm. And so that's where I honed the craft and then ended up in San Francisco, where I was a big band singer and working the hotel and country club circuits for about 25 years. And then 1997, I relocated to Sacramento and have been here ever since, and have been somewhat active in the jazz scene here in Sacramento.
So here we are in 2016, the very end of the year, And you have developed the Sacramento Jazz Cooperative, the beginnings of it, now known as SJC. So what prompted you, you know, to start this nonprofit?
Well, I wish I could say, it would be way cool if I could say it was an original thought. I based it on a model that has been working across the nation. San Francisco has SF Jazz. It took them about 30 years to make that be what it is today. We have Cuamba down in the Santa Cruz area. And then I actually based SJC off of a Miami model called the Miami Jazz Co-op. So our mission as a 501c3 is to establish and operate a dedicated jazz facility in Sacramento for jazz musicians and their audiences. And it is hoped by doing that we can not only expand on the classic jazz market, but we can also acknowledge the American art form of jazz, not only through performance, but also by outreach and education.
So this would really embrace all jazz. And what I kind of see is that, you know, our beloved Sacramento Traditional Jazz Society, the Capital Jazz Project, other jazz groups, this could actually be a performance space for all jazz musicians.
Absolutely. It is an expansion of everything that is already going on.
Can you explain a little bit how it works, like in Miami, since that's the model?
They have opened up a facility where there are performances, there's a jazz lounge, there are performances, there's classes, there are workshops, everything geared to the musician. And I just think that's something that is lacking today. We have hardworking musicians out there who get their own gigs and work in the clubs and have private parties, but there's nothing really for the musician. There's not a work room, a workshop. Where do you go for rehearsals? How do you, how do you build on your audience? Where do you perform? Mm-hmm. So it's just a facility and just geared to musicians and their audiences. Performance space for locals and for touring musicians.
We have a lot of fantastic jazz musicians in the Sacramento area that do work really hard. A lot of them teach. And in this first series of fundraisers for SJC, you performed the first one. You were the guinea pig, right?
I was the guinea pig. I was the cheap labor.
And tonight it is the second performance of this first group in December.
Yes.
And Joe Gilman is going to bring his quartet. And let's hear a little bit of a Gershwin tune from Joe.
Absolutely.
Beautiful work of Joe
Absolutely.
Gilman. So tell us about where these introductory shows are taking place.
Well, we started this venture with absolutely no money. And so the idea was to kick off some fundraising performances to get us going. And so that's what they have been about. As you mentioned, I kicked it off last week. We have Joe tonight. We have Mel Martin next Monday. And then we're going to take a little breather in January, and then we're going to kick it off again in February with an exciting lineup. So these performances have just been starters, and we really appreciate the musicians who have contributed to this effort.
I'm talking with Carolyn Swayze. She is the founder of the Sacramento Jazz Cooperative. So right now the performance space for these fundraisers is temporary, and where is that?
We have been using the facilities at 2420 N Street. That's the E. Clare Performing Arts Center, known also as the Clare Auditorium. It's the old Fremont School in Midtown. So the performances are every Monday at from 7 p.m. until 9:30. We hope that we can take as much advantage of that space as possible over the next few weeks.
And so tonight is Joe Gilman. It gets underway at 7 o'clock.
7 p.m. We are selling advance tickets still through Eventbrite.com. Anyone who buys tickets up until 6 o'clock tonight can get a 20% discount on those tickets.
The last performer in this first group of December performances is Mel Martin, originally from Sacramento.
Yes. Yes.
Let's take a little listen to Mel Martin. So you have some fantastic shows. That's a beautiful Mel Martin.
Absolutely.
Tell me who's coming up in February when you kick off those Monday night performances.
We have Darius Barbazeta. We have Jacob Manrick. We have Jackie Ryan coming in from San Francisco. And then we have Dave Bass on the 27th of February. So
great lineup.
All four Mondays in February. Really looking forward to it.
So once again, the long term, the marathon.
It is a marathon. It is certainly not a race.
For the vision is to have a performance space for so many of these artists, local artists, maybe touring artists coming through Northern California. How might the educational aspect quickly take shape in SJC, do you think?
Well, on different levels, we hope to be able to supplement some of the schools. There are a lot of young students coming up interested in jazz. Anytime you do a show where someone learns something that they didn't know before, in a sense, that's an educational component.
Sure.
That was one of the reasons why we started off with Harry Warren. So many people know the music of Harry Warren but didn't actually know the composer. So as we build, get our board of directors going, get more members, we hope to go after some grant money for education and supplement educational jazz wherever we can.
And someday have your own facility.
That is the goal.
That is the goal. Well, we have a Grammy-nominated vocalist, Jackie Ryan, who is part of the lineup in February. She is phenomenal. Let's hear some Jackie Ryan.
Guy, and that's for true. Monkey man, a lucky guy, and that is you. Talking about the way you always had an extra buck, tickets in your hand, and that is luck. So they call you lucky, lucky monkey. You walk on a velvet carpet all day. You're a lucky guy at 21. Monkey man, you won a grand, and that was fun. Now I hear you telling us to come and see the yacht.
I've been talking with Carolyn Swayze, founder of the Sacramento Jazz Cooperative. Carolyn, thank you for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is Insight for today. I'm Beth Duncan. Our producers are Jen Picard, Cody Drabble, Christopher Remington. Today's engineer was Matt Passini. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thank you for joining us on Insight.